He practically never stuttered throughout that period. One time he said, "There are abstracts of the records of General Pritcher. I know him. He was the Foundation renegade who combed the galaxy for the Second Foundation, wasn't he?" "Not exactly a renegade, Arcady. The mule had converted him." "Oh, it's the same thing." "Galaxy, that combing you speak of was a hopeless task. The original records of the Selden Convention that established both foundations 500 years ago make only one reference to the Second Foundation. They say it's located at the other end of the galaxy, at Star's End. That's all the mule and Pritcher had to go on. They had no method of recognizing the Second Foundation, even if they found it. What madness!" "They have records." He was speaking to himself, but Arcadia listened eagerly. "Which must cover nearly 1,000 worlds, yet the number of worlds available for study must have been closer to 1,000,000. And we are no better off." Arcadia broke in anxiously, "Shh!" in a tight hiss. Homer froze and slowly recovered. "Let's not talk," he mumbled. And now Homer was with Lord Stettin, and Arcadia waited outside alone and felt the blood squeezing out of her heart for no reason at all. That was more frightening than anything else, that there seemed no reason. On the other side of the door, Homer, too, was living in a sea of gelatin. He was fighting with furious intensity to keep from stuttering and, of course, could scarcely speak 2 consecutive words, clearly as a result. Lord Stettin was in full uniform, 6'6", large-jawed and hard-mouthed. His bald, arrogant fists kept a powerful time to his sentences. "Well, you have had 2 weeks, and you come to me with tales of nothing. Come, sir, tell me the worst. Is my navy to be cut to ribbons? Am I to fight the ghosts of the Second Foundation as well as the men of the First? I repeat, my lord, I am no predictor. I am at a complete loss." "Or do you wish to go back to warn your countrymen? To deep space with your play-acting? I want the truth, or I'll have it out of you along with half your guts."
"I'm telling only the truth, and I'll have you remember, my lord, that I am a citizen of the Foundation. You cannot touch me without harvesting more than you count on."
The Lord of Calgan laughed uproariously. "A threat to frighten children. A horror with which to beat back an idiot. Come, Mr. Munn, I have been patient with you. I have listened to you for 20 minutes while you detailed wearisome nonsense to me, which must have cost you sleepless nights to compose. It was wasted effort. I know you are here not merely to rake through the mule's dead ashes and to warm over the cinders you find. You come here for more than you have admitted. Is that not true?" Homer Munn could no more have quenched the burning horror that grew in his eyes than, at that moment, he could have breathed. Lord Stettin saw that and clapped the Foundation man upon his shoulder so that he and the chair he sat on reeled under the impact. "Good. Now let us be frank. You are investigating the Selden plan. You know that it no longer holds. You know, perhaps, that I am the inevitable winner now. I and my heirs." "Well, man, what matters it who established the Second Empire, so long as it is established? History plays no favorites, eh? Are you afraid to tell me? You see that I know your mission." Munn said thickly,
"What is it you want?
Your presence. I would not wish the plan spoiled through overconfidence. You understand more of these things than I do. You can detect small flaws that I might miss. Come, you will be rewarded in the end. You will have your fair glut of the loot. What can you expect at the Foundation? To turn the tide of a perhaps inevitable defeat? To lengthen the war? Or is it merely a patriotic desire to die for your country? He finally spluttered into silence. Not a word would come. You will stay, said the Lord of Calgan, confidently. You have no choice. Wait, an almost forgotten afterthought. I have information to the effect that your niece is of the family of Beta Durell. Homer uttered a startled, yes. He could not trust himself at this point to be capable of weaving anything but cold truth. It is a family of note on the Foundation. Homer nodded. To whom they would certainly brook no harm. Harm? Don't be a fool, man. I am meditating the reverse. How old is she? 14? So. Well, not even the Second Foundation or Harry Seldon himself could stop time from passing or girls from becoming women. With that, he turned on his heel and strode to a draped door which he threw open violently. He thundered, "What in space have you dragged your shivering carcass here for?" The Lady Calia blinked at him and said in a small voice, "I didn't know anyone was with you." "Well, there is. I'll speak to you later of this, but now I want to see your back, and quickly." Her footsteps were a fading scurry in the corridor. Stettin returned. She is a remnant of an interlude that has lasted too long. It will end soon. 14, you say? Homer stared at him with a brand new horror. Arcadia started at the noiseless opening of a door, jumping at the jangling sliver of movement it made in the corner of her eye. The finger that crooked frantically at her met no response for long moments, and then, as if in response to the cautions enforced by the very sight of that white, trembling figure, she tiptoed her way across the floor. Their footsteps were a taut whisper in the corridor. It was the Lady Calia, of course, who held her hand so tightly that it hurt, and for some reason, she did not mind following her. Of the Lady Calia, at least, she was not afraid. Now, why was that? They were in a boudoir now, all pink fluff and spun sugar. Lady Calia stood with her back against the door. She said, "This was our private way to me, to my room, you know, from his office. His, you know." And she pointed with a thumb as though even the thought of him were grinding her soul to death with fear. "It's so lucky. It's so lucky." Her pupils had blackened out the blue with their size. "Can you tell me?" began Arcadia timidly. And Calia was in frantic motion. "No, child, no. There is no time. Take off your clothes. Please, please. I'll get you more, and they won't recognize you." She was in the closet, throwing useless bits of flummery and reckless heaps upon the ground, looking madly for something a girl could wear without becoming a living invitation to dalliance. "Here. This will do. It will have to. Do you have money? Here, take it all. And this." She was stripping her ears and fingers. "Just go home. Go home to your Foundation." "But Homer, my uncle." She protested vainly through the muffling folds of the sweet-smelling and luxurious spun metal being forced over her head. "He won't leave. Poochie will hold him forever, but you mustn't stay." "Oh, dear, don't you understand?"
"No."
Arcadia forced to stand still. "I don't understand." Lady Calia squeezed her hands tightly together.
"You must go back to warn your people there will be war. Isn't that clear?"
Absolute terror seemed paradoxically to have lent a lucidity to her thoughts and words that was entirely out of character.
"Now come."
Out another way. Past officials who stared after them but saw no reason to stop one whom only the Lord of Calgan could stop with impunity. Guards clicked heels and presented arms when they went through doors. Arcadia breathed only on occasion through the years the trip seemed to take. Yet from the first crooking of the white finger to the time she stood at the outer gate, with people and noise and traffic in the distance, was only 25 minutes. She looked back with a sudden, frightened pity.
I don't know why you're doing this, my lady, but thanks. What's going to happen to Uncle Homer?"
"I don't know," wailed the other.
"Can't you leave? Go straight to the spaceport. Don't wait. He may be looking for you this very minute."
And still Arcadia lingered. She would be leaving Homer, and belatedly, now that she felt the free air about her, she was suspicious.
"But what do you care if he does?"
Lady Calia bit her lower lip and muttered, "I can't explain to a little girl like you. It would be improper."
"Well, you'll be growing up, and I met Poochie when I was 16. I can't have you about, you know."
There was a half-ashamed hostility in her eyes. The implications froze Arcadia. She whispered, "What will he do to you when he finds out?" And she whimpered back, "I don't know," and threw her arm to her head as she left at a half-run, back along the wide way to the mansion of the Lord of Calgan. But for one eternal second, Arcadia still did not move, for in that last moment before Lady Calia left, Arcadia had seen something. Those frightened, frantic eyes had momentarily, flashingly, lit up with a cold amusement. A vast, inhuman amusement. It was much to see in such a quick flicker of a pair of eyes, but Arcadia had no doubt of what she saw. She was running now, running wildly, searching madly for an unoccupied public booth at which one could press a button for public conveyance. She was not running from Lord Stettin. Not from him or from all the human hounds he could place at her heels. Not from all his 27 worlds rolled into a single gigantic phenomenon, hallooing at her shadow. She was running from a single, frail woman who had helped her escape. From a creature who had loaded her with money and jewels, who had risked her own life to save her. From an entity she knew, certainly and finally, to be a woman of the Second Foundation. An air taxi came to a soft clicking halt in the cradle. The wind of its coming brushed against Arcadia's face and stirred at the hair beneath the softly furred hood Calia had given her. "Where'll it be, lady?" She fought desperately to low-pitch her voice to make it not that of a child.
"How many spaceports in the city?"
2. "Which one you want?"
"Which is closer?"
He stared at her. "Calgan Central, lady."
"The other one, please. I've got the money."
She had a 20-Calganid note in her hand. The denomination of the note made little difference to her, but the taxi man grinned appreciatively. "Anything you say, lady. Skyline cabs take you anywhere." She cooled her cheek against the slightly musty upholstery. The lights of the city moved leisurely below her. What should she do? What should she do? It was in that moment that she knew she was a stupid, stupid little girl, away from her father and frightened. Her eyes were full of tears, and deep down in her throat there was a small, soundless cry that hurt her insides. She wasn't afraid that Lord Stetton would catch her. Lady Callia would see to that. Lady Callia. Old, fat, stupid, but she held on to her lord, somehow. Oh, it was clear enough now. Everything was clear. That tea with Callia at which she had been so smart. Clever little Arcadia. Something inside Arcadia choked and hated itself. That tea had been maneuvered, and then Stetton had probably been maneuvered so that Homer was allowed to inspect the palace after all. She, the foolish Callia, had wanted it so, and arranged to have smart little Arcadia supply a foolproof excuse, one which would arouse no suspicions in the minds of the victims, and yet involve a minimum of interference on her part. Then why was she free? Homer was a prisoner, of course. Unless she went back to the Foundation as a decoy. A decoy to lead others into the hands of them. So she couldn't return to the Foundation. Spaceport, lady. The air taxi had come to a halt. Strange. She hadn't even noticed. What a dream world it was. Thanks. She pushed the bill at him without seeing anything and was stumbling out the door, then running across the springy pavement. Lights. Unconcerned men and women. Large, gleaming bulletin boards with the moving fingers that followed every single spaceship that arrived and departed. Where was she going? She didn't care. She only knew that she wasn't going to the Foundation. Anywhere else at all would suit. Oh, thank Selden for that forgetful moment, that last split second when Callia wearied of her act, because she had to do only with a child and had let her amusement spring through. And then something else occurred to Arcadia, something that had been stirring and moving at the base of her brain ever since the flight began, something that forever killed the 14 in her. And she knew that she must escape. That above all. Though they located every conspirator on the Foundation, though they caught her own father, she could not, dared not risk a warning. She could not risk her own life, not in the slightest, for the entire realm of Terminus. She was the most important person in the galaxy. She was the only important person in the galaxy. She knew that even as she stood before the ticket machine and wondered where to go. Because in all the galaxy, she and she alone, except for they themselves, knew the location of the second Foundation. Trantor. By the middle of the interregnum, Trantor was a shadow. In the midst of the colossal ruins, there lived a small community of farmers. Encyclopedia Galactica. Chapter 15. Through the Grid. There is nothing, never has been anything, quite like a busy spaceport on the outskirts of a capital city of a populous planet. There are the huge machines resting mightily in their cradles. If you choose your time properly, there is the impressive sight of the sinking giant dropping to rest, or, more hair-raising still, the swiftening departure of a bubble of steel. All processes involved are nearly noiseless. The motive power is the silent surge of nucleons shifting into more compact arrangements. In terms of area, 95% of the port has just been referred to. Square miles are reserved for the machines, and for the men who serve them, and for the calculators that serve both. Only 5% of the port is given over to the floods of humanity, to whom it is the way station to all the stars of the galaxy. It is certain that very few of the anonymous many-headed stop to consider the technological mesh that knits the spaceways. Perhaps some of them might itch occasionally at the thought of the thousands of tons represented by the sinking steel that looks so small off in the distance. One of those cyclopean cylinders could, conceivably, miss the guiding beam and crash half a mile from its expected landing point, through the glassite roof of the immense waiting room, perhaps, so that only a thin organic vapor and some powdered phosphates would be left behind to mark the passing of 1,000 men. It could never happen, however, with the safety devices in use, and only the badly neurotic would consider the possibility for more than a moment. Then what do they think about? It is not just a crowd, you see. It is a crowd with a purpose. That purpose hovers over the field and thickens the atmosphere. Lines queue up. Parents herd their children. Baggage is maneuvered in precise masses. People are going somewheres. Consider then the complete psychic isolation of a single unit of this terribly intent mob that does not know where to go, yet at the same time feels more intensely than any of the others possibly can the necessity of going somewheres, anywhere, or almost anywhere. Even lacking telepathy or any of the crudely definite methods of mind touching mind, there is a sufficient clash in atmosphere, in intangible mood, to suffice for despair. To suffice. To overflow and drench and drown. Arcadia Durrell, dressed in borrowed clothes, standing on a borrowed planet in a borrowed situation of what seemed even to be a borrowed life, wanted earnestly the safety of the womb. She didn't know that was what she wanted. She only knew that the very openness of the open world was a great danger. She wanted a closed spot somewhere, somewhere far, somewhere in an unexplored nook of the universe, where no one would ever look. And there she was, age 14 plus, weary enough for 80 plus, frightened enough for 5 minus. What stranger of the hundreds that brushed past her, actually brushed past her so that she could feel their touch, was a second foundationer? What stranger could not help but instantly destroy her for her guilty knowledge, her unique knowledge of knowing where the second foundation was? And the voice that cut in on her was a thunderclap that iced the scream in her throat into a voiceless slash. "Look, miss," it said irritably, "are you using the ticket machine or are you just standing there?" It was the first she realized that she was standing in front of a ticket machine. You put a high denomination bill into the clipper, which sank out of sight. You pressed the button below your destination and a ticket came out together with the correct change, as determined by an electronic scanning device that never made a mistake. It was a very ordinary thing, and there is no cause for anyone to stand before it for 5 minutes. Arcadia plunged a 200-credit into the clipper and was suddenly aware of the button labeled Trantor. Trantor. Dead capital of the dead empire. The planet on which she was born. She pressed it in a dream. Nothing happened, except that the red letters flicked on and off, reading 172.18. 172.18. 172.18. It was the amount she was short. Another 200-credit. The ticket was spit out toward her. It came loose when she touched it and the change tumbled out afterward. She seized it and ran. She felt the man behind her pressing close, anxious for his own chance at the machine, but she twisted out from before him and did not look behind. Yet there was nowhere to run. They were all her enemies. Without quite realizing it, she was watching the gigantic, glowing signs that puffed into the air. Stefani, Anacreon, Fermus. There was even one that ballooned Terminus, and she longed for it, but did not dare. For a trifling sum, she could have hired a notifier, which could have been set for any destination she cared, and which would, when placed in her purse, make itself heard only to her, 15 minutes before takeoff time. But such devices are for people who are reasonably secure, however, who can pause to think of them. And then, attempting to look both ways simultaneously, she ran head-on into a soft abdomen. She felt the startled out-breath and grunt, and a hand came down on her arm. She writhed desperately, but lacked breath to do more than mew a bit in the back of her throat. Her captor held her firmly and waited. Slowly he came into focus for her, and she managed to look at him. He was rather plump and rather short. His hair was white and copious, being brushed back to give a pompadour effect that looked strangely incongruous above a round and ruddy face that shrieked its peasant origin. "What's the matter?" he said finally, with a frank and twinkling curiosity. "You look scared." "Sorry," muttered Arcadia in a frenzy. "I've got to go. Pardon me." But he disregarded that entirely and said, "Watch out, little girl. You'll drop your ticket." And he lifted it from her resistless white fingers and looked at it with every evidence of satisfaction. "I thought so," he said, and then bawled in bull-like tones, "Mama!" A woman was instantly at his side, somewhat more short, somewhat more round, somewhat more ruddy. She wound a finger about a stray gray lock to shove it beneath a well-outmoded hat. "Papa," she said reprovingly, "why do you shout in a crowd like that? People look at you like you were crazy. Do you think you are on the farm?" And she smiled sunnily at the unresponsive Arcadia and added, "He has manners like a bear." Then, sharply, "Papa, let go the little girl. What are you doing?" But Papa simply waved the ticket at her. "Look," he said, "she's going to Trantor." Mama's face was a sudden beam. "You're from Trantor? Let go her arm, I say, Papa." She turned the overstuffed valise she was carrying onto its side and forced Arcadia to sit down with a gentle but unrelenting pressure. "Sit down," she said, "and rest your little feet. It will be no ship yet for an hour, and the benches are crowded with sleeping loafers." "You are from Trantor?" Arcadia drew a deep breath and gave in. Huskily, she said, "I was born there." And Mama clapped her hands gleefully. "1 month we've been here. Until now, we met nobody from home. This is very nice. Your parents?" She looked about vaguely. "I'm not with my parents," Arcadia said carefully. "All alone? A little girl like you?" Mama was at once a blend of indignation and sympathy. "How does that come to be?" "Mama," Papa plucked at her sleeve, "let me tell you. There's something wrong. I think she's frightened." His voice, though obviously intended for a whisper, was quite plainly audible to Arcadia. "She was running. I was watching her, and not looking where she was going. Before I could step out of the way, she bumped into me. And you know what? I think she's in trouble."
"So shut your mouth, Papa. Into you, anybody could bump."
But she joined Arcadia on the valise, which creaked wearily under the added weight, and put an arm about the girl's trembling shoulder. "You're running away from somebody, sweetheart. Don't be afraid to tell me. I'll help you." Arcadia looked across at the kind gray eyes of the woman and felt her lips quivering. One part of her brain was telling her that here were people from Trantor, with whom she could go, who could help her remain on that planet until she could decide what next to do, where next to go. And another part of her brain, much the louder, was telling her, in jumbled incoherence, that she did not remember her mother, that she was weary to death of fighting the universe, that she wanted only to curl into a little ball with strong, gentle arms about her, that if her mother had lived, she might. And for the first time that night, She was crying. Crying like a little baby and glad of it, clutching tightly at the old-fashioned dress and dampening a corner of it thoroughly, while soft arms held her closely and a gentle hand stroked her curls. Papa stood helplessly looking at the pair, fumbling futilely for a handkerchief which, when produced, was snatched from his hand. Mama glared an admonition of quietness at him. The crowd surged about the little group with the true indifference of disconnected crowds everywhere. They were effectively alone. Finally, the weeping trickled to a halt, and Arcadia smiled weakly as she dabbed red eyes with the borrowed handkerchief.
"Golly," she whispered,
"Shh, shh, don't talk," said Mama, fussily. "Just sit and rest for a while. Catch your breath. Then tell us what's wrong, and you'll see. We'll fix it up, and everything will be all right." Arcadia scrabbled what remained of her wits together. She could not tell them the truth. She could tell nobody the truth. And yet she was too worn to invent a useful lie. She said whisperingly, "I'm better now."
"Good," said Mama. "Now, tell me why you're in trouble. You did nothing wrong?"
"Well, of course, whatever you did will help you. But tell us the truth." "For a friend from Trantor, anything," added Papa expansively. "Eh, Mama?"
"Shut your mouth, Papa," was the response, without rancor.
Arcadia was groping in her purse. That, at least, was still hers, despite the rapid clothes changing forced upon her in Lady Callia's apartments. She found what she was looking for and handed it to Mama.
"These are my papers," she said diffidently.
It was shiny, synthetic parchment which had been issued her by the Foundation's ambassador on the day of her arrival, and which had been countersigned by the appropriate Kalganian official. It was large, florid, and impressive. Mama looked at it helplessly and passed it to Papa, who absorbed its contents with an impressive pursing of the lips. He said, "You're from the Foundation?"
"Yes, but I was born in Trantor. See, it says that..."
"Aha! That looks all right to me. You're named Arcadia, huh? That's a good Trantorian name. But where's your uncle? It says here you came in the company of Homer Munn, uncle."
"He's been arrested," said Arcadia drearily.
"Arrested?" from the two of them at once.
"What for?"
asked Mama.
"He did something?"
She shook her head.
"I don't know.
We were just on a visit. Uncle Homer had business with Lord Stedden, but..." She needed no effort to act a shudder. It was there. Papa was impressed. "With Lord Stedden. Your uncle must be a big man." "I don't know what it was all about, but Lord Stedden wanted me to stay." She was recalling the last words of Lady Callia, which had been acted out for her benefit. Since Callia, as she now knew, was an expert, the story could do for a second time. She paused, and Mama said interestedly, "And why you?"
"I'm not sure. He
wanted to have dinner with me all alone, but I said no, because I wanted Uncle Homer along. He looked at me funny and kept holding my shoulder." Papa's mouth was a little open, but Mama was suddenly red and angry. "How old are you, Arcadia?"
14 and a half, almost."
Mama drew a sharp breath and said that such people should be let live. "The dogs in the streets are better. You're running from him, dear, is not?" Arcadia nodded. Mama said, "Papa, go right to information and find out exactly when the ship to Trantor comes to berth. Hurry." But Papa took one step and stopped. Loud metallic words were booming overhead, and 5,000 pairs of eyes looked startledly upwards. "Men and women," it said with sharp force, The airport is being searched for a dangerous fugitive, and it is now surrounded. No one can enter, and no one can leave. The search will, however, be conducted with great speed, and no ships will reach or leave berth during the interval, so you will not miss your ship. I repeat, no one will miss his ship. The grid will descend. None of you will move outside your square until the grid is removed, as otherwise we will be forced to use our neuronic whips. During the minute or less in which the voice dominated the vast dome of the spaceport's waiting room, Arcadia could not have moved if all the evil in the galaxy had concentrated itself into a ball and hurled itself at her. They could mean only her. It was not even necessary to formulate that idea as a specific thought. But why? Kalia had engineered her escape. And Kalia was of the Second Foundation. Why, then, the search now? Had Kalia failed? Could Kalia fail? Or was this part of the plan, the intricacies of which escaped her? For a vertiginous moment, she wanted to jump up and shout that she gave up, that she would go with them, But Mama's hand was on her wrist. Quick, quick, we'll go to the ladies' room before they start. Arcadia did not understand. She merely followed blindly. They oozed through the crowd, frozen as it was, into clumps, with the voice still booming through its last words. The grid was descending now, and Papa, open-mouthed, watched it come down. He had heard of it and read of it, but had never actually been the object of it. It glimmered in the air, simply a series of cross-hatched and tight radiation beams that set the air aglow in a harmless network of flashing light. It always was so arranged as to descend slowly from above in order that it might represent a falling net with all the terrific psychological implications of entrapment. It was at waist level now, 10 feet between glowing lines in each direction. In his own 100 square feet, Papa found himself alone, yet the adjoining squares were crowded. He felt himself conspicuously isolated, but knew that to move into the greater anonymity of a group would have meant crossing one of those glowing lines, stirring an alarm, and bringing down the neuronic whip. He waited. He could make out over the heads of the eerily quiet and waiting mob the far-off stir that was the line of policemen covering the vast floor area, lighted square by lighted square. It was a long time before a uniform stepped into his square and carefully noted its coordinates into an official notebook. Papers! Papa handed them over, and they were flipped through in expert fashion. You're Preem Palver, native of Trantor on Kalgan for a month, returning to Trantor. Answer, yes or no?
Yes, yes.
What's your business on Kalgan?
I'm trading representative of our farm cooperative.
I've been negotiating terms with the Department of Agriculture on Kalgan.
Mm-hmm.
Your wife is with you? Where is she?
She is mentioned in your papers.
Please. My wife is in the... He pointed.
Hanto! Roared the policeman. Another uniform joined him.
The first one said dryly, Another dame in the can by the galaxy. The place must be bussing with them. Write down her name.
He indicated the entry in the papers which gave it.
Anyone else with you?
My niece.
She's not mentioned in the papers.
She came separately.
Where is she? Never mind. I know. Write down the niece's name too, Hanto. What's her name? Write down Arcadia Palver. You stay right here, Palver. We'll take care of the women before we leave.
Papa waited interminably. And then, long, long after, Mama was marching toward him, Arcadia's hand firmly in hers, the two policemen trailing behind her.
They entered Papa's square, and one said, Is this noisy old woman your wife?
Yes, sir, said Papa placatingly.
Then you'd better tell her she's liable to get into trouble if she talks the way she does to the First Citizens Police.
He straightened his shoulders angrily. Is this your niece?
Yes, sir.
I want her papers. Looking straight at her husband, Mama slightly, but no less firmly, shook her head. A short pause, and Papa said with a weak smile, I don't think I can do that.
What do you mean you can't do that?
The policeman thrust out a hard palm. Hand it over.
Diplomatic immunity, said Papa softly.
What do you mean?
I said I was trading representative of my farm cooperative. I'm accredited to the Kalganian government as an official foreign representative, and my papers prove it. I showed them to you, and now I don't want to be bothered anymore.
For a moment, the policeman was taken aback. I've got to see your papers. It's orders.
You go away, broke in Mama suddenly. When we want you, we'll send for you, you bum.
The policeman's lips tightened. Keep your eye on them, Hanto. I'll get the lieutenant.
Break a leg, called Mama after him. Someone laughed and then choked it off suddenly. The search was approaching its end. The crowd was growing dangerously restless. 45 minutes had elapsed since the grid had started falling, and that is too long for best effects. Lieutenant Dirridge threaded his way hastily, therefore, toward the dense center of the mob. Is this the girl? He asked wearily. He looked at her, and she obviously fitted the description. All this for a child. He said, her papers, if you please. Papa began, I have already explained. I know what you have explained, and I'm sorry, said the lieutenant, but I have my orders, and I can't help them. If you care to make a protest later, you may. Meanwhile, if necessary, I must use force. There was a pause, and the lieutenant waited patiently. Then Papa said huskily, Give me your papers, Arcadia. Arcadia shook her head in panic, but Papa nodded his head. Don't be afraid. Give them to me. Helplessly, she reached out and let the documents change hands. Papa fumbled them open and looked carefully through them, then handed them over. The lieutenant, in his turn, looked through them carefully. For a long moment he raised his eyes to rest them on Arcadia, and then he closed the booklet with a sharp snap. All in order, he said. All right, men. He left, and in 2 minutes, scarcely more, the grid was gone, and the voice above signified a back to normal. The noise of the crowd, suddenly released, rose high. Arcadia said, How? Papa said, Shh, don't say a word. Let's better go to the ship. It should be in the berth soon. They were on the ship. They had a private stateroom and a table to themselves in the dining room. 2 light-years already separated them from Kalgan, and Arcadia finally dared to broach the subject again. She said, But they were after me, Mr. Palver, and they must have had my description and all the details. Why did he let me go? And Papa smiled broadly over his roast beef. Well, Arcadia, child, it was easy. When you've been dealing with agents and buyers and competing cooperatives, you learn some of the tricks. I've had 20 years or more to learn them in. You see, child, when the lieutenant opened your papers, he found a 500-credit bill inside, folded up small. Simple, no? I'll pay you back. Honest, I've got lots of money. Well, Papa's broad face broke into an embarrassed smile as he waved it away. For a countrywoman, Arcadia desisted. But what if he'd taken the money and turned me in anyway, and accused me of bribery? And give up 500 credits? I know these people better than you do, girl. But Arcadia knew that he did not know people better. Not these people. In her bed that night, she considered carefully and knew that no bribe would have stopped a police lieutenant in the matter of catching her, unless that had been planned. They didn't want to catch her, yet had made every motion of doing so nevertheless. Why? To make sure she left? And for Trantor? Were the obtuse and soft-hearted couple she was with now only a pair of tools in the hands of the Second Foundation, as helpless as she herself? They must be. Or were they? It was all so useless. How could she fight them? Whatever she did, it might only be what those terrible omnipotents wanted her to do. Yet she had to outwit them. Had to. Had to. Had to. Chapter 16. Beginning of War. For reason or reasons unknown to members of the galaxy at the time of the era under discussion, Intergalactic Standard Time defines its fundamental unit, the second, as the time in which light travels 299,776 kilometers. 86,400 seconds are arbitrarily set equal to one intergalactic standard day, and 365 of these days to one intergalactic standard year. Why 299,776? Or 86,400? Or 365? Tradition, says the historian, begging the question. Because of certain and various mysterious numerical relationships, say the mystics, cultists, numerologists, metaphysicists. Because the original home planet of humanity had certain natural periods of rotation and revolution from which those relationships could be derived, say a very few. No one really knew. Nevertheless, the date on which the Foundation cruiser, the Hober Mallow, met the Kalganian squadron, headed by the Fearless, and, upon refusing to allow a search party to board, was blasted into smoldering wreckage, was 185-11692 GE. That is, it was the 185th day of the 11,692nd year of the Galactic Era, which dated from the accession of the first emperor of the traditional Campbell dynasty. It was also 185-455 SE, dating from the birth of Selden, or 185-376 FE, dating from the establishment of the Foundation. On Kalgan, it was 185-76 FC, dating from the establishment of the first citizenship by the Mule. In each case, of course, for convenience, the year was so arranged as to yield the same day number regardless of the actual day upon which the era began. And in addition to all the millions of worlds of the galaxy, there were millions of local times based on the motions of their own particular heavenly neighbors. But whichever you choose, 185, 11692, 455, 376, 76, or anything, it was this day which historians later pointed to when they spoke of the start of the Stettinian War. Yet, to Dr. Durrell, it was none of these at all. It was simply and quite precisely the 32nd day since Arcadia had left Terminus. What it cost Durrell to maintain stolidity through these days was not obvious to everyone. But Elvet Semek thought he could guess. He was an old man and fond of saying that his neuronic sheaths had calcified to the point where his thinking processes were stiff and unwieldy. He invited and almost welcomed the universal underestimation of his decaying powers by being the first to laugh at them. But his eyes were nonetheless seeing for being faded, his mind nonetheless experienced and wise for being no longer agile. He merely twisted his pinched lips and said, "Why don't you do something about it?" The sound was a physical jar to Durrell, under which he winced. He said, gruffly, "Where were we?" Semek regarded him with grave eyes. You'd better do something about the girl. His sparse, yellow teeth showed in a mouth that was open in inquiry. But Durrell replied coldly, The question is, can you get a Symes-Molf resonator in the range required? Well, I said I could, and you weren't listening. I'm sorry of it. It's like this. What we're doing now can be more important to everyone in the galaxy than the question of whether Arcadia is safe. At least to everyone but Arcadia and myself, and I'm willing to go along with the majority. How big would the resonator be? Semek looked doubtful. I don't know. You can find it somewheres in the catalogs. About how big? A ton? A pound? A block long? Oh, I thought you meant exactly. It's a little jigger. He indicated the first joint of his thumb. About that. All right. Can you do something like this? He sketched rapidly on the pad he held in his lap, then passed it over to the old physicist, who peered at it doubtfully, then chuckled. You know, the brain gets calcified when you get as old as I am. What are you trying to do? Durrell hesitated. He longed desperately at the moment for the physical knowledge locked in the other's brain, so that he need not put his thought into words. But the longing was useless, and he explained. Semek was shaking his head. You'd need hyper-relays. The only things that would work fast enough. A thundering lot of them. But it can be built. Well, sure. Can you get all the parts? I mean, without causing comment? In line with your general work? Semek lifted his upper lip. Can't get 50 hyper-relays. I wouldn't use that many in my whole life. We're on a defense project now. Can't you think of something harmless that would use them? We've got the money. Maybe I can think of something. How small can you make the whole gadget? Hyper-relays can be had micro-size. Wiring. Chips. Space, you've got a few hundred circuits there. I know. How big? Semek indicated with his hands. Too big, said Durrell. I've got to swing it from my belt. Slowly he was crumpling his sketch into a tight ball. When it was a hard yellow grape, he dropped it into the ashtray, and it was gone with a tiny white flare of molecular decomposition. He said, Who's at your door? Semek leaned over his desk to the little milky screen above the door signal. He said, The young fellow, Anthor. Someone with him, too. Durrell scraped his chair back. Nothing about this, Semek, to the others yet. It's deadly knowledge if they find out, and two lives are enough to risk. Peleus Anthor was a pulsing vortex of activity in Semek's office, which somehow managed to partake of the age of its occupant. In the slow turgor of the quiet room, the loose, summery sleeves of Anthor's tunic seemed still a-quiver with the outer breezes. He said, Dr. Durrell, Dr. Semek, Orem Dirige. The other man was tall, a long, straight nose that lent his thin face a saturnine appearance. Dr. Durrell held out a hand. Anthor smiled slightly. Police Lieutenant Dirige, he amplified. Then, significantly, of Calgan. And Durrell turned to stare with force at the young man. Police Lieutenant Dirige of Calgan, he repeated distinctly. And you bring him here. Why? Because he was the last man on Calgan to see your daughter. Hold, man. Anthor's look of triumph was suddenly one of concern, and he was between the two, struggling violently with Durrell. Slowly and not gently, he forced the older man back into the chair.
What are you trying to do?
Anthor brushed a lock of brown hair from his forehead, tossed a hip lightly upon the desk, and swung a leg thoughtfully. I thought I was bringing you good news.
Durrell addressed the policeman directly.
What does he mean by calling you the last man to see my daughter? Is my daughter dead? Please tell me without preliminary.
His face was white with apprehension.
Lieutenant Dirridge said expressionlessly, Last man on Calgan was the phrase. She's not on Calgan now. I have no knowledge past that.
Here, broke in Anthor, let me put it straight.
Sorry if I overplayed the drama a bit, Doc. You're so inhuman about this, I forget you have feelings. In the first place, Lieutenant Dirridge is one of us. He was born on Calgan, but his father was a Foundation man brought to that planet in the service of the Mule. I answer for the Lieutenant's loyalty to the Foundation. Now, I was in touch with him the day after we stopped getting the daily report from Mun.
Why? Broke in Durrell fiercely.
I thought it was quite decided that we were not to make a move in the matter. You were risking their lives and ours.
Because, was the equally fierce retort, I've been involved in this game for longer than you. Because I know of certain contacts on Calgan of which you know nothing. Because I act from deeper knowledge. Do you understand?
I think you're completely mad.
Will you listen?
A pause, and Durrell's eyes dropped. Anthor's lips quirked into a half-smile.
All right, Doc. Give me a few minutes. Tell him, Dirridge.
Dirridge spoke easily. As far as I know, Dr. Durrell, your daughter is at Trantor. At least she had a ticket to Trantor at the Eastern Spaceport. She was with a trading representative from that planet who claimed she was his niece. Your daughter seems to have a queer collection of relatives, Doctor. That was the second uncle she had in a period of 2 weeks, huh? The Trantorian even tried to bribe me. Probably thinks that's why they got away. He smiled grimly at the thought.
How was she?
Unharmed, as far as I could see. Frightened. I don't blame her for that. The whole department was after her. I still don't know why.
Durrell drew a breath for what seemed the first time in several minutes. He was conscious of the trembling of his hands and controlled them with an effort.
Then she's all right. This trading representative, who was he? Go back to him. What part does he play in it?
I don't know. Do you know anything about Trantor?
Well, I lived there once.
It's an agricultural world now. Exports, animal fodder and grains, mostly. High quality. They sell them all over the galaxy. There are a dozen or two farm cooperatives on the planet, and each has its representatives overseas. Shrewd sons of guns, too. I knew this one's record. He'd been on Calgan before, usually with his wife. Perfectly honest. Perfectly harmless.
Said Anthor. Arcadia was born in Trantor, wasn't she, Doc?
Durrell nodded.
It hangs together, you see. She wanted to go away, quickly and far, and Trantor would suggest itself.
Don't you think so?
Durrell said, why not back here?
Perhaps she was being pursued and felt that she had to double off in a new angle, eh?
Dr. Durrell lacked the heart to question further.
Well then, let her be safe on Trantor. Or as safe as one could be anywhere in this dark and horrible galaxy.
He groped toward the door, felt Anthor's light touch on his sleeve, and stopped, but did not turn.
Mind if I go home with you, Doc?
You're welcome, was the automatic response. By evening, the exteriormost reaches of Dr. Durrell's personality, the ones that made immediate contact with other people, had solidified once more. He had refused to eat his evening meal and had instead, with feverish insistence, returned to the inchwise advance into the intricate mathematics of encephalographic analysis. It was not till nearly midnight that he entered the living room again. Pelias